My name is Hugh McClelland. I was born into a mining family. My grandfather, my uncles and my father were all miners. They worked in the Lanarkshire coalfield in Scotland. When the Lanarkshire coalfield finished, or was on its way out, one of my uncles and my father decided to try their luck in Ayrshire, which is about 60 miles difference. So it was quite a big difference. They came from a town environment to a village environment in the wilds in Scotland, if you like. Dunmallington was the name of the place in South Ayrshire. I was about 9 years old when my family moved to Dunmallington. So I was kind of educated there. My education was not that great, really. Somebody told me that we were never intended to be intellectuals. We were only fodder for the mines, really, because there were about five mines in the village where I lived. My family come from Hamilton. I know my grandfather was a coal miner, and my uncles and my father, but the only other thing I know about my family is that in Hamilton, my grandfather's brother, he was in haulage. I think he had Gavin McClelland. They had the first, horse-drawn bus in Hamilton, that type of thing. But that's the only thing, that's as far as I can go back on my father's side.
So you moved from Lanarkshire to Ayrshire because your dad was looking for better work, basically.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. That was in 1949, and he worked there for the rest of his life. And then gradually you could see what the writing was on the wall, that the coal fields were contracting. So I consider that I moved at a really good time before they all closed, because most of my mates and that were working in the pits, a lot of them my age went into forestry commission. So
the pits ran out of coal up in Scotland much earlier than they did in
Yorkshire. Yeah, you could see that happening.
So why did you come to Wateraig?
I'd married a girl from Leeds. I met and married a girl from Leeds, and she couldn't settle. Basically, she couldn't settle in Leeds, in Dunmallington. So I decided if we were going to save the marriage, I would come to Leeds.
So did you get a transfer through the coal board then?
No. I did it quite spontaneous myself. I felt as if I had to act pretty fast, and I had made up my mind. I didn't need no help from nobody, because in them days you could move from pit to pit, no problem. If you fell out with the management, that is the overman, the deputies, you could just up sticks and go to another mine, and they would set you on. You could finish work on the Monday in one mine, you could finish work on the Friday and start work on the Monday in another mine. It was that easy.
Because there was a lot of work about, basically.
Yeah. They were always seeking miners. There used to be big adverts on billboards asking for mine. They used to say something like, we've enough coal in this coal field to last 1,000 years. I remember them big billboard things, you know. And I thought, how wrong they were, you know.
And this is the 1950s, isn't it?
This is 1960s, you know. I started work in the pit in 1953 in Dunmallington. On the surface, you do, say, maybe a year on the surface. You get the general feel. They don't just throw you into the deep end. You're going underground. You have to do a certain amount of training. In fact, in Scotland, it was different here in Yorkshire, but in Scotland, you had to go to a place called Muir Kirk. And you went away from home for 6 weeks and you had special training. And we stayed at a place, it used to be the Duke of Hamilton's residence, and then the coal board got hold of it. You did a week underground, and then you did a week at school, and that lasted for 12 weeks, not 6 weeks, 12 weeks you were away from home. And then you come back to the mine, and then you continued your training, maybe for another year after that. You'd do several things. You'd do what we used to call it brushing, but they call it ripping in Yorkshire. Then drawing off, you'd be on the coal face, but you were under supervision. On the ripping, you might be under two or three men. On drawing off, you'd be One man would supervise you. You would be him helping him, and then on the coal face, you'd be with a man who needed help who was near retiring age. And he wasn't as strong as maybe some of the rest of the men, so you would be under his supervision and you'd be helping him. And that's how you did. You gradually progressed through the mine.
So to summarise, you were in Dalmellington.
Yeah.
You'd married Barbara, who came from Leeds.
Yeah.
She wasn't happy, and you decided that you better come and find a job in Leeds.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Tell me that story about how you ended up at Water Egg.
I didn't know much about the area. I wanted to leave the pit and continue with what I knew, because I threatened to tackle something different. So I thought, I'll stick to coal mining, and maybe once I get into the pit here, I can progress from the pit to something else. But anyway, I arrived in Leeds. I decided I'd give Leeds a go. And
how did you get to Leeds?
On the train. Yeah, I got the train at Kilmarnock. A minute to ten. I always remember that. Arriving probably 4 hours later in Leeds. And I made my way straight to the bus station when I got off the train. And there were a lady at one of the bus stops. And I asked her if she could tell me the way to the nearest coal mine. And she said, yeah. She says that my bus passes one of the coal mines. She says, if you get sat with me, she says, I'll show you where to get off. So when we got to Wurlesford, she pointed at where Fleet Lane was. So I had to go down to Fleet Lane, maybe 3/4 mile, something like that, and the pit was there. I asked for a job, got directed to the training officer, whose name escapes me at the minute. But so he said, yeah, we can set you on.
So this is all in that same day as you came down from Scotland?
Yeah, yeah. There's quite a story attached to that. I'd actually gone underground, got told I was going to go to Clean Belts up. That affected my money, so I thought, right, that's it. That is the straw that broke the camel's back.
This is up in Scotland?
Yeah, and I decided then I would go to Leeds. I know I'm backtracking a bit, but this happened. On 7 o'clock we started. I was on the train at a minute to 10, coming to Leeds. Found myself in the bus station, asked a woman, she pointed me way to the pit. I went to the pit, got my job, and then I was short of money, so I decided I would hitchhike home. So I hitchhiked back to Scotland, and it took me till the next morning, till 6:30 the next morning, to arrive back in Dalmellington. And rather than go home, I went straight to the pit, did my shift, and come back out at night. And my family in Scotland, they didn't know where I'd been. You've disappeared for 24 hours. Where have you been? That's it. I've been to Leeds to find a job in the pit. I'm moving. My mother was aghast. My father was upset because they didn't want to lose me. So that meant...
And what was Barbara's reaction?
Oh, well, she was delighted. Oh, yeah, she was coming back home. She could be with her mother and the rest of the family. Oh, she was over the moon.
Had you got any children by then?
No, that come quite a bit later.
So let me get this right. You, one morning, about 7 o'clock in the morning, you decided, I've got to go and get a job in Yorkshire. And it just took you just over 24 hours to get to Yorkshire, get the job, and get back there and tell your family you got the job.
Yeah, I didn't want to miss a shift, you see, because money was that tight. I thought, well, I was jiggered, I was tired, but I thought, I can do my shift. And then I can get back and I'll get me sleep then.
Did you ever see that lady who you met on the bus? Did you ever see her again?
No. That would have been interesting. No, I never. I'd never recognise her in a million years. No.
And in fact, you live in Swillington now, so it's pretty certain that that bus that you got was the bus that was going to come up through Swillington.
Yeah, that same bus is probably still running. You know, the bus between Castleford, Leeds and Pontefract, probably. It's probably the same bus is still running.
So, once you got the job, how long then did it take you to actually move Barbara and get established at Water Egg?
That's the story, I know. So I had to go back to the pit in Dalmellington, tell the management, put my notice in, and I was called back into the manager's office. He wanted to know why I decided to up sticks and go to Leeds. Well, he didn't know where I was going to go. He knew I was going to England. But he says, are you going to the car industry? I says, no. I says, I'm going to the coal mine, still working in the pit. Oh, he says, well, I'm pleased about that. He says, I thought we were losing you out the industry. He says, it's good that you're staying in the industry. He says to me, if you ever need a job, if you can't settle there, come back and there's a job for you here.
So it shows you how free and easy it was to get work in that.
Oh, yeah, it was simple then. I think it was simple for everybody, really. You know, in them days, you could move around at will from job to job.
Why was it that you just didn't go to your management in Scotland and say, I'm a bit unhappy here, can you get me a job down in Leeds?
Yeah, well, I couldn't understand the ropes. Maybe that was the proper way to go about things. I wanted to do it my way, and I decided, if it had come to it, if it really had come to it, I wouldn't have, if I couldn't get in the pit, I would have taken something else. The copper works were, they were setting men on quite free and easy in them days, but I was lucky I got into the pit, and I enjoyed the pit, I really did, because I made a terrific amount of friends. They were so friendly. Well, the Yorkshire men, it was unbelievable. They would encourage you to come to the pub. And maybe it was my accent. I think they liked my accent as well. And because I didn't speak like I do now. I was much broader in them days. And so we went from the pub. We used to meet Saturday morning, go for a pint, go for a bit to eat, maybe a pie or something like that, sandwich. And then we'd get a taxi. In them days, you used to get a taxi and go down to Ellen Road. So we had a good time, you know. We'd get in amongst, maybe four of us from Waterhead, four of us together. I remember Phil Callaghan, who was really friendly with. We used to sit there in the crowd, stand in the crowd, and we had a little sweep going. Amongst the rest, there were men we didn't know, but you'd have a little sweep. Who would score the first goal? I won it one time. So I got, it was half a crown a time. So I don't know how many. There must have been about 11 or 12 of us, you know, had run this little sweep. And I was delighted. I was over the moon.
Tell me about the work, though. When you got to Waterage, tell me about your shifts and what you did underground.
Yeah, when I arrived there, they put me on night shift because they didn't know what I could do and what I couldn't do. So they put me with this old Irishman who was repairing roads. So I was on nights. That didn't go down well with me because I like to be up in the morning on day shift and get it over with. But I was on nights repairing this road with this old Irishman, and he said to me, and I always remember this, he says, we'd fill the tub. He says, now we'll need to go get the horse. Can you go up there, top of the gate, and bring the horse down? So I went up to fix the horse down, but the horse won't come. So anyway, I tried all sorts to come over, pulling it and calling it names, but it won't move for me. So I had to go back. I didn't want to go back, but I had to go back and tell the fella, well, I can't bring this horse down because it won't come. So he says, that's your accent. He says,
they didn't understand you.
They didn't understand me. The horse didn't understand me. So I went down, and anyway, we got over that, and then gradually I got onto the ripping side because we were always short of men for face work. So I got to onto ripping.
Let me just stop you there. Can you just explain some of these words you're using?
Yeah.
You said roadway and you said gate. Now you've just started talking about ripping. So for people who don't understand what it was like underground, what do you mean? What's a roadway for a start?
Well, we'll call it, the roadway is the gate. So you have your coal face advances. So you have a roadway or a gate each side. You have a because it's got to be ventilated to take the gas away as well.
And those roadways are at right angles to the face.
That's
right,
yeah. And they take the air, usually the loader gate, that's where the belt runs, the loader gate, that's usually the intake for the air. The fresh air comes in that roadway, goes through the face and comes out on the return side, the return gate. And that's how the face is ventilated.
And the gate is sort of the entrance to where the coal face is.
Yeah, the gate is the roadway. I'm using two names, but I can stick to one. You can call it the roadway, but I think the gate is more a Yorkshire slang. You know what the Yorkshire miners would call the roadway.
Right, so when you started then, you had to help this old Irish bloke at night to make sure the roadways were clear of debris and that sort of thing,
isn't it? Yeah, well, mainly what it was weight that was coming on. You have your arches, and then you've got pressure coming from the sides and from the roof, and the girders got all bent and twisted. So the old ones have to be taken out and new ones put in. That was our work at that time.
And these are effectively tunnels?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they are tunnels as the roadways.
So once you'd done that and you proved that you were a good lad, so to speak, you got put onto a better shift where you were actually ripping the coal out?
Yeah, no, well, I got sent ripping. That is where the making the road was. Your coal seam might be, say, 3 or 4 feet high, and then above that you've got rock. So you just the coal face workers take the coal, and then the rippers come and they take the muck, the rock above it, they fire it down so that you've got a nice walkway in. You've got it could be 8 to 10 feet high, round maybe to that round, and so I was on that for a bit. And then I didn't like the night shift, so I went to Granville Craven, the under manager, and I asked him if I could, any chance of me getting on the day shift. Yeah, he says start on Monday on the day shift. So I went on the day shift, and I went on the market, as we call the market.
Now what's that?
Where you couldn't go directly onto a coal face, because all those jobs were taken with regular men, but if one of them was off work, what they used to call laking. If one of the men laked, well, then that was your chance. If you were lucky, you could take his place maybe for the day or 2 days. He might be ill.
He might be ill, or he might be pulling a sickie.
That's right. So sometimes on a coal face, there might be, say, 12, 15 men. And whenever a gap appeared, then that was your chance. If you were on the market, Your other man would say to you, right, go on Joe Bloggs's stint. So it could be anywhere on the face. So gradually I got on the face, and that was in Waterhaig. It was in the Beeston seam, which was a warm seam, dusty seam. It'd be 4'6" high. So I got on there. It was damn hard work, because...
And how did you get the coal out in those days? Once you got to work on that, what was the process of actually getting the coal out?
Yeah, what it was pick and shovel and a hammer. That was for your shovel, obviously, for shoveling coal, your pick for picking, and your hammer for putting the supports up, the wooden supports or the steel supports. So you needed a hammer to bring them up. So, and the coal was undercut. A machine come, and it cut it at the bottom of the seam between the muck and the coal, and it cut about 6 inches on the bottom. So it would throw all this, what we used to call duffy. That was all your cuttings from the machine. And the idea was that you cleaned all your duffy, if you want to call it that, duffy, or your cuttings, and you cleaned them all up first. You made a nice, tidy road through at the length of your stint. That might be 8-9 yards, depending on the height. So say if it were 9 yards, so you cleaned it all up, and then you had to clean under the cut, under the seam, and take it all out, and then you had holes drilled at maybe 6 feet intervals all the way through. And once the undercut was nice and clean, you could shout for the shot firer. He would come and put a shot in.
Explosives.
And then you'd fire it, and then you were left, hopefully, with a nice mound of coal that you could just get in and just shovel. So you could be in a trance, just shoveling away there onto the conveyor. You might have blown maybe 4 or 5 foot down, and that took a wee while for to shift that coal. Now, once you'd shift it, then you had your wooden straps or steel straps, whatever they were, and whatever pit the pit was using, and then you had your support. So you had to support it every yard, every 3 feet that it had to be supported.
Can I just take you back a bit? You said there was a machine that undercut, as you said, the coal.
Yeah.
Can you describe that? The way I think you're describing it, it's a bit like a very big Black & Decker saw, like a power saw.
Yeah,
that you would use for cutting trees down.
Yeah, that's right. Like a power saw. The machine itself was a big, heavy thing. It was low lying. It would be, what would it be, 8 or 9 foot long, with a big jib. We called it a jib. It had a 6 foot jib, and that would go under the coal. It would cut its way under the coal. It would only be 18 inch high, something like 18, 20 inches high. It made a 6 foot cut. If you had a 6 foot jib, it made a 6 foot jib. And then you only had maybe a shovel, maybe 3 foot, 2 foot six, 3 foot long, and that one couldn't get to the back, so you had a special shovel. You know, you've seen these where they do the pizzas. You know, these right big long shovels. You had a shovel like that, and you had to get right to the end, you had to use this long shafted shovel to get to the back of your cut, to clean. It was important that the undercut had to be cleaned, because if that weren't cleaned out, your gumming under it was solid, because the weight come on and made it solid. And you had to get that out so that you had got maximum effect of your shot. So when the explosive went off, it would force it down, smash it all up.
So if the Beeston seam is about 3 to 4 feet high,
yeah,
you cut out about 18 inches of it at the bottom of it.
No, it would maybe be about 6 inches, the cut.
And then the rest of the 3 foot or 3 foot six, which would fall down into that space.
Had to be blown down with your explosives. Yeah, and you had a job of getting to the back where it was solid. That was a new seam, you know, that was a new face.
Did you yourself operate the coal cutting machine, or was that done by
other men? No, that was done in a different shift. I was on the day shift, as a collier. The cutting was done in the night shift usually. And
so that sort of space, that hole underneath, was already waiting for you every morning.
Every morning, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I see. And were other men then responsible for the conveyor belt?
Yeah, yeah. On the day shift did the coaling, as they called it. They took the coal out. The afternoon shift moved the conveyor up, because the coal face advanced all the time, so your conveyors had to be. So you had your colliers on day shift, you had drawers off, and men for to move the belts forward, and then you had the ripping maybe on the night shift, usually. When mechanisation came in, it got a bit different, because mechanisation, the face was advancing at a faster pace, so you might have to do some ripping on the day shift, or wherever you could fit it in, wherever you could get them in.
And mechanisation meant that you didn't have to use a shovel?
No, well, you had to use the shovel. You used the shovel to keep your... because there were always cuttings, spillage. You used the coal or the shovel to clean your stint, but it was a lot easier. It was just tidying it up, really, with the shovel, so you could get your supports. You knew where you were putting your supports. But it was a lot easier when mechanisation come.
And when did that happen at Waterhaig?
At Waterhaig, mechanisation would be, I'd say, about 63, when we started getting plough faces in.
And what's that?
A plough, it's just like a big plough. That was in the yard seam. It was 3 feet. And you had this plough, just on the end of a big chain. You know, like a snow plough, a miniature version of that, but it was had a double blade. So it used to go up and, like, shear it off the coal, go up and down it, the chain. There'd be a motor at each end of the face, and that would drag this big plough. It would just shear it off, just plough it onto the conveyor, because the conveyor was here, and the plough went up and down.
And when mechanisation come in, then did they mechanise putting the props up to keep the roof up as well?
Ah, yeah. Well, that was a gradual process. You were still when we were on the plough face to start with. The plough went through and loaded the coal, and then you had small doughty props, hydraulic props. You had to pump them up. They were like as high as a seam, like that. And they were that thick, and they were made by Doughty, and you put your key in, and you pumped them up, and that supported the roof, And gradually, eventually that gave way to chocks, hydraulic chocks. Some people used to call them walking chocks. But the chocks at Waterhead had four legs at the back, all steel. These are steel base, steel canopy, and four wooden legs at the back and one at the front that held the canopy, which, you know, it was supported over the conveyor. So I got the job. I was put on to maintain the chocks. That was my the first chock fitter at Waterhead. And there was quite a bit of work to do there, because it's just like if the hydraulics have a leak, it's just like your bicycle wheel. When you've got a puncture, they can't support the roof. So my job was to maintain the hydraulics on the chocks. And in fact, when you look down that face, if it had all these chocks on, you look down the travelling road, it was like a steel tunnel, and then you had your conveyor at the front, and this big chain, it was steel to steel. You had a big heavy chain, links. It used to be banging on the conveyor all the time, and the conveyor was a steel conveyor with steel bars across it. Used to take the coal away, and this chain would bang, bang, bang. And I know, man, that it affected their hearing at the end of the day. That was before we got earmuffs and things like that.
So what we're talking about now is the period of time in the late 60s before the pit closed.
Oh, yeah.